This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We're following the footsteps of Malcolm when he set up the organization of Afro-American Unity. We are one people. Our struggles are connected. And only once we kind of connect those struggles and connect with each other are we really ever going to be successful.
African Stream, a new text and video media outlet, offers an anti-war, anti-imperialist perspective on Africa.
When these people are voting this weekend for Vladimir Putin or for any of the four candidates, those candidates get the vote. When you vote for president of the United States, your candidate doesn't get a vote. You're voting for an elector.
Russia is holding its presidential election. We hear from an international elections observer.
I didn't know what Medicare Advantage was until I switched from Medicare to Medicare Advantage, because the Medicare Advantage people, they lie and they say, yes, this is Medicare, when in fact it's not.
New York City retirees fight against the privatization of their health care through Medicare Advantage.
No justification to do a vent and burn. Rightfully, Norfolk Southern's contractors said, ruled out hot tapping and transloading, but there was another option.
Biden's National Transportation Safety Board chairperson admits that the controlled explosion and burn following the Norfolk Southern train wreck in East Palestine, Ohio, was unnecessary. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. African Stream is an anti-war, anti-imperialist news and public affairs outlet based in Nairobi, Kenya. I spoke to its founder and editor-in-chief, Ahmed Kabalo.
African Stream is a wonderful video and text website, an anti-war, anti-imperialist site. Can you tell me how it was founded? How did you get started?
Okay, so African Stream, for me, was an idea, because I used to work as a journalist for many years, and I was always trying to pitch stories about Africa. And I've worked for anti-imperialist media, but they did tell me before that unfortunately people are not interested in Africa, that it's just not one of the hot topics, that, you know, the Middle East is where it's at, America, North America, South America, Europe, that's what people's eyeballs are glued to, that's where the interest lies. So I've always been passionate about Africa. I'm an African person. My future is Africa, my past, my present. So I was always determined to kind of prove that mantra wrong, that we can create an anti-imperialist platform that focuses exclusively on Africa, and that people will be interested, not just Africans, majority of our audience is Africans, but anti-imperialist and anti-war people from all over the world that want to build a broad movement of anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist and anti-war, and want to see a different way in which the world operates.
Are you yourself from Kenya?
No, I'm from Sudan.
I'm from Sudan.
Yes. I knew that for me to set up an African media, for it to have any credibility, it needed to be somewhere in the African continent, you know, operated by Africans, from the camera operators to the editors to everyone to be African. So then it was a question of where shall I set up? It had to be English speaking. And I just basically set up a chart of different important things for setting up a company, press freedoms, safety. You know, I always planned to relocate here with my family. How easy is it in terms of connectivity to other places if I wanted to fly to different parts of Africa? Internet speed, infrastructure. So yeah, there was a few options, but Kenya came out on top.
How is African Stream structured?
So there's me as the chief editor. We have, beneath me, we have two managers. We have three now output editors that kind of check and help for quality control, check the information that the journalists come up with is verifiable. It's verifiable from not just one, but several sources. Check the structure of the story. You know, we're always trying to compete for the attention of people whose attention spans are shrinking by the day. But then it's me and the two managers in the Kenyan office that do the final check. And then we have, in the Kenyan office, we have four full-time journalists. We have three editors, three camera operators. And then we work with two freelancers in Burkina Faso and then two freelancers in the country that you're residing in, one in Chicago and one that you might know of, actually. She used to be part of Black Alliance for Peace. She's one of our output editors.
And how do you decide? Do you broadcast and post text every day? Or do you do it at a particular time? Or do you just do it as it becomes available?
So most of the team in Kenya, most of the team works from 8 till 5. And then the freelancers work from 10 till 7. And we have a couple of people in the Kenyan office who work from 10 till 7. So essentially we treat it as a 9 to 5. From Monday to Friday, we're getting stories, looking for stories, reading, researching, finding out what's going on in the continent, in the diaspora, what's happening in Haiti, what's the latest in Jamaica, in South Africa. And then we're just with the four journalists full time and the two freelancers and the couple of freelancers that we have dotted around the world. They're always pitching stories. I'm also constantly pitching stories to journalists. And then we schedule, obviously, people that work on the weekend. So we schedule our posts. So we try to do about 10 posts a day on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. That reduces to about six on a Saturday, six on a Sunday. And yeah, so we're just constantly trying to keep that content going, trying to keep people updated. We get messages from the audience. Why are you guys not covering what's going on in Cape Verde? Why are you guys not covering this? Why are you guys not covering that? Which is actually very helpful. Because, yeah, you know, it's quite a challenge to know what's happening in 54 countries in the continent and in the diaspora and beyond without having journalists in each country. So the audience is actually very helpful by their complaining about us not covering a story, because it alerts us to something that we need to look into. But what also what helps is a lot of the journalists also come from community organizing. So beyond the reach of the journalists that we have, we also connected to many different groups in different countries in the continent and throughout the diaspora. So sometimes there might be something that the mainstream media is reporting in a certain way, but we need to get the on the ground perspective on what the real story is.
So you consider your beat the Black world worldwide, not just the African continent.
Exactly. From the start, and we've been very consistent on that. We're following the footsteps of Malcolm when he set up the organization of Afro-American Unity. And when he went to the African state and tried to lobby African states to support his charge against the United States for human rights violations, we are one people. Our struggles are connected. And only once we kind of connect those struggles and connect with each other, are we really ever going to be successful.
Do you have an editorial policy to determine whether or not you're going to take an editorial stance, say, on a particular issue? Go ahead.
Yes, we do. And the editorial policy is constantly in review. So with all the journalists, we have a meeting every Thursday, 12 o'clock Kenya time. So we have an editorial policy that we've devised over the time that we've been here. But then there's always tricky topics and contradictions that we need to discuss. For example, what was going on in Venezuela and Guyana was one of those said topics that needed to be explored, and many conversations and speaking to different people and just trying to figure out what's going on. Because broadly, as leftists, as socialists, as Pan-Africanists, we support the Bolivarian Revolution and the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. But then in that situation, it was definitely something that we needed to interrogate and understand what was going on, because it didn't look good. So at the time, with that story, for example, we tried to hold off before we jumped into the story and figure out what was going on and investigate and speak to many different sources, read as many different sources as possible, places like the Black Agenda Report, Hood Communist, etc. And by the time we did, it seemed to have settled down and it seemed to have reached some sort of agreement. But yeah, we're constantly in discussion. We have policy on many things. For example, Western Sahara, we have a very clear editorial policy on supporting the on Western Sahara's right for self-determination. Editorial policy on what's going on in the DRC, we see as a Western aggression in the DRC, but it's carried out by proxy states of Rwanda and Uganda. We think that this is because the DRC is minerally very wealthy, and that for the extraction of these resources, there needs to be a constant state of destabilization in Eastern DRC. And that there are some states that are willing to participate in this. Rwanda went in there under the guise of taking out what they call Hutu extremists, but that was 30 years ago now. And now their mission goals, mission aims have very clearly changed. So we have policies on these things, and we're constantly discussing and reflecting on these policies so that everybody in the team is aware of where we stand on these things. It makes the job of the output editors a lot easier, makes the job of me as the final check a lot easier. If the journalists, the people that come on an internship, know where we stand. We take a very clear position on Israel-Palestine, and we oppose settler colonialism in all of its forms. We attempt to interrogate the reasons why Israel has so much support in Africa. We've done a story on evangelical churches in the United States and their support for evangelical Zionist movement in Africa. So yeah, we took a position on Niger that was informed largely because we managed to have somebody on the ground that was speaking to people in Niamey, telling us what the sentiment was on the ground. You know, we looked into who Mohamed Bazoum was, the former president, who he had links with, the election results, why people seem to be out in the streets in Niamey, why was there so much enthusiasm for these men in military uniforms, and so on. Burkina Faso and Mali, we support this confederation of alliance of Sahelian states that's going to be formed between Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. And that's what we want ultimately in the continent of Africa: more unity, more pooling of resources, more mutual defense. You know, people criticize the fact that Russia is in Africa supporting the security process there. Our argument is there would be no need for Russia, there'd be no need for anyone else if we united and we pulled our resources together to defend one another and to speak with one voice when on the global stage.
Is there anything you'd like to say about Haiti? And given that it's the worst crisis in Africa, is there anything else you'd like to say about the DRC?
Sure. I'll start off with Haiti. So we've been covering Haiti quite a lot on African Stream from very different angles. We had a reporter that managed to find out where Ariel Henry was going to be and tabled a question in an event where there was no questions to be asked. And what's going on in Haiti is very sad. It's very sad for Kenya in particular, because, you know, it's really damaged, I think, the Kenyan reputation on the global stage by Africans globally, and obviously very sad for the Haitians. Now, there is this misperception that because Haiti, there's a problem in Haiti and gangs are running riot in Haiti, that the solution is US funded, backed, sponsored intervention. And we refute that and we reject that. The United States occupied Haiti for 19 years, stole many of its resources in that time, installed a dictator, and has been actively destabilizing Haiti ever since. Removed its only democratically elected president. And they are the people that are sponsoring this, what they're calling Kenyan-led police deployment. But I would argue it's not a Kenyan-led police deployment. It's a US-led police deployment. We actually have someone on the ground in Haiti, and we've been covering the situation from the very start of when we launched African Stream. And the sentiment in Port-au-Prince is the same sentiment in Nairobi. They do not want an intervention. All they want is that all the guns and the arms that have been flooded into Haiti to stop. The government is being armed by the US, but then the gangs are allegedly receiving their weapons from Miami, Florida. So they're both coming from the same source. If the United States wanted to really help the people of Haiti, that's how they would do it. They would stop the arms from being flooded into the country.
Okay, and DRC?
DRC.
Just for anyone who doesn't, just to be really clear, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Go ahead.
Yeah. The DRC needs everyone's attention and everyone's support. The only way that we're going to stop the crisis in the DRC is if we interrupt the supply chain. So at the moment, because we're trying not to do this ourselves, a lot of media's falling into this, Paul Kagame. We criticize Paul Kagame. We're very critical of Paul Kagame. But unless we expose the supply chain and who else is benefiting from this resource extraction, then when Paul Kagame is dead and gone, there'll be another figure destabilizing the DRC. When Museveni of Uganda is dead and gone, there'll be another figure destabilizing the DRC. So we really need to make sure that there's more accountability from these companies like the Tesla, like the Apple, like the Glencore, in regards to this resource extraction, because that's what's fueling the instability. If there was nothing underneath the ground apart from dirt, then the DRC wouldn't be in the situation that it's in right now.
That was Ahmed Gbalo, founder and editor-in-chief of African Stream, an anti-war, anti-imperialist news and public affairs outlet based in Nairobi, Kenya. African Stream can be found on the web at africanstream.media.
Do you all know fake news? Do you know fake news? Do you know fake news, man? Everywhere I go in Europe for the last 2 years and America, everybody's crazy about this shit. Everybody's losing their goddamn minds. Fake news, fake news, fake news. Fake news. Relax, everybody. Take it easy. Calm down, man. You see, in the motherland where I'm from, we have been under fake news for 400 years, man. Welcome to the party. Yeah.
That was Black Times by Shayan Kuti. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Russia held its presidential election from March 15 to 17. Capitalism, Race, and Democracy's Polina Vasilyev spoke to Pacifica contributor Don DeBar, who is visiting Russia as an international elections observer.
Okay, so the part of the election process that we're observing is the actual voting days. They have having 3 days of polling. You know, the polls are open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. This is new here. This is the first time that they've tried this. It's, obviously, it's intended to make it easier to vote for people who fit into their schedules. It's part of a trend globally. In the United States, they have different devices also that they've used. And there's some, you know, wrestling over which things are safer and which things are not. Certainly, there's political motivations behind that, probably even here, although I'm not familiar enough with the party struggles to know which, you know, the nuances of that. So what I witnessed, you know, what we're being asked to witness is the actual conduct of the election at the polls. So we go to open the polls and see how that happens. They have a machine that has a zero count on it. The registration rolls are laid out. The people who, you know, person the tables for the voters to come in. The procedure for the voter, you walk to a polling place. They're well marked. There's this logo sign that's everywhere. And every place is very physically inviting. You know, plenty of doors open and people to help you walk in and all of that. The people are very friendly. There's a very, I would say, adequate presence of security, not intimidating, but comforting to, you know, the hoodlums are not going to walk through here or whatever. You walk into a table. There's maybe a dozen people sitting from left to right along the table. They break the alphabet up or they break up the district or somehow. You go to the person that's closest to what you know, your name or your address, and they look on the voting rolls to see if you're a registered voter. And if you are, they hand you a ballot. You take the ballot and walk to a little booth, just like we have here now with the curtains and around it. You just kind of walk halfway in, fill it out in secret, come out with the ballot, take it over to a scanner, put it in the machine. The machine tallies the vote and then drops the ballot into the box so that it's retained. I had the opportunity to spend about 10, 15 minutes speaking with the governor of this area about the procedures. And beginning with this one, who does the primary count? And they said that the primary count is done by electronics. And then, however, the physical ballots are preserved, you know, under seal. And in the event there is a challenge to the count from that machine, an allegation or an intimation of fraud or some malfunction or whatever, that they will then go to the paper ballot and that in that case, the paper ballot is authoritative. And so, the, you know, this is essentially the identical process to what we have in New York. And, you know, in terms of it being conducted, it's professionally, it seemed pretty much the same as it is in Ossining, where I live, although some of the people seemed a little friendlier than the people at the polling place near my house. There's a couple of crabby old ladies that work there.
Well, let's talk about the election itself. Russians are only electing their president.
That's correct, right now. Yes.
Right. And contrary to what some people may think, there are actually candidates on the ballot. Could you talk about that? A lot of people don't know that one of the main opposition parties in Russia is actually the Communist Party. They have a candidate on the ballot. How popular are they?
Well, actually, that's the leading opposition party. There are four candidates on the ballot, and there's a pretty even playing field. Once you're on the ballot, there are strict limits on how much money you can use for campaign purposes of any kind, advertising, mailing, taking a vacation from the campaign, whatever. And there are funding mechanisms so that it's pretty much a level playing field in that area. You know, it's not a level playing field when you have a very popular incumbent, of course, which is an interesting part of this whole mixture that's never mentioned in the West. They have to make reference to the fact that President Putin enjoys somewhere between 60 and 80% positive ratings, depending on when and where the polling was taken and by whom. But no one ever asks why. They make it sound like there's drugs in the water or, you know, some guy with a gun at everybody's head to make them feel happy or whatever. In fact, anyone that's familiar with the condition of Russia from the time that he came into power in 1998, 1999 until now would understand exactly why he's popular. This government, because it's not him, good or bad, Vladimir Putin isn't Russia. Vladimir Putin is the president of Russia. Russia is a large country with 150 million people. That large country with 150 million people has built a remarkable success economically, politically, and socially over the last 21 years that is the envy of just about everyone on the planet, well, with the exception of China, because it's also done the same thing, and the United States, because we don't have a clue what the hell goes on over here. So the process of getting on the ballot, which is, I think, a much more important aspect than a lot of the other things that are emphasized. And it's a point of contention in the U.S. media. Compared to the process in the United States, the process here is a dream. To be a candidate in a nation of 150 million people, you have to have 100,000 signatures submitted on a petition. You have 30-something days, about the same period of time that you would have in the United States for doing it. And if the signatures are valid, they get tested like they do in the United States and challenged. And there's a procedure for doing that and an appeal process also. But if you do it, you're on the ballot. If you qualify by age, if you qualify by not having committed any felonies or whatever. The United States doesn't just have one ballot, first of all. You have 50 elections when you run for president in the United States. See, in Russia, the presidential election is conducted by the federal government. So there's one election. There's polling places everywhere. There's, I forget, 100,000 polling places or something. There's ample facilities, and they're convenient to everyone, pretty much. In the United States, you have 50, under the Constitution of the United States, elections are conducted by the states, not the federal government. There are some federal guidelines in the U.S. Constitution. The strongest one that I know of directs that the conduct of the election be determined by the state legislatures. And so you have 50 different sets of rules, 50 different calendars, 50 different sets of bureaucrats, by the way, who are going to interfere or manipulate the process, and 50 different sets of laws, meaning 50 different sets of lawyers to participate in any of these things. And so in New York and California, I forget what the number of signatures are to get on the ballot, but I think just those two states, the total of them is more than 100,000 required in Russia. You know, we've heard all these complaints from the State Department and the CIA and, of course, the newspapers who get their information from the State Department and the CIA that the late Navalny and also the so-called peace candidate, Nadezhda, I forget what his name is, they were denied ballot access, Navalny, because he was involved in criminal activity that was not a question that that's what was happened, and adjudicated. And the other submitted 105,000 signatures at the deadline, and some of them were dead people. The things that you have, anyone who's done that kind of work knows that, here, I've got 10, my 10 kids are going to go petition for me, okay? Five of them are going to knock on every single door, and they're going to look at everybody's ID, and they're going to do each and everything that's required. And the people themselves, each of them know which party they're enrolled in. They don't misremember or whatever. And those signatures will be perfect. this other kid over here, I don't know what it is about him. He takes after his mother's family or something, but that kid's going to go to the bar and he's going to go down to the cemetery and write down names or whatever and come give me the petition so he gets his money too. And somebody's going to investigate this and those signatures are going to be determined to be no good. And that's what happened to him. With 100,000 signatures, if you're gathering them in Los Angeles or Brooklyn or whatever, you figure you need to get at least 150,000 to be in there safe, because some of them are going to be legitimately discounted because they're incorrect. Wrong spelling of the name, the person moved and forgot to tell you, you know, just things that do not correspond to the strict requirements of the statute. And some of them are going to be close enough where some crooked guy in the Board of Elections or whatever can say, that one's no good too. So if you have 150,000 for 100, you're going to have no question that you have enough. And that's what you're supposed to do. So this guy got 105,000. And so he wasn't on the ballot. He, you know, challenged it through the appeals process and it failed. Three other candidates besides President Putin were on the ballot. One is the Communist Party's candidate. One is the candidate of the Liberal Democratic Party, LDP, which is Zhirinovsky's old party. And the other is a member of a young guy, 40-year-old guy, who is a member of a new political party that's just forming. It's called the New Russian, New something, New People's Party, something, whatever. There's no real, you know, it's wartime here.
Yeah.
And I mean, it doesn't feel like it at all. This is really important context. I'm in a country that is under war, isn't in war with NATO. I don't know. The bars are still open at night. You know, people are going. I was walking around with a bunch of kids yesterday singing, and, you know, I went to see some music, and they went to a hockey game the other night and a basketball game last night. Life seems very normal here. But politically, the people themselves are very supportive of the defense of their country, which is what they're looking. They see it that way because that's how it is, because there's some people from way across the sea that are at our borders. How else would you see it? So that stuff isn't really an issue. The guy who they're calling the peace candidate, quote unquote, who advocated to end the war, didn't specify the mechanism by which he would do it, because the war wasn't decided by Russia. The war was decided by NATO. And so the only way for this guy to end the war would be either to give NATO whatever they want or to talk NATO into stopping it. And I can't imagine that that's possible or probably would have happened already. So outside of that, almost everything here works so well. It'd be hard for me to pick an issue if I were running against Vladimir Putin or whoever was in office right now, because the people have seen such tremendous improvement in their lives that it would be a hard sell to tell them something else has to change. Again, President Putin is expected to win with an absolute majority and perhaps a substantial margin. In the previous elections, the second place party had been the Communist Party. But I'm not sure that this candidate is going. He's polling at around 4 or 5% now, and the other two candidates are going to be. I think this is the first election for the LDP's new candidate, because I think Zhirinovsky only died 2 years ago or something, whatever.
Right.
His polling data is around 4 or 5% also, but who knows? And then this young guy, the new party guy, is a complete unknown. We're going to see what happens. The thing that, one point that I want to make, the two people that were kept off the ballot here by the mechanisms of the process, their polling data together, the two of them polling together, was less than 1%. Now, I'd like to just compare that to something that's going on. Forget how you feel about either one of these two, Robert Kennedy or Donald Trump, okay? We'll start with Trump because he's polling higher. He's been polling steadily in the 40s from the beginning, 40s, okay? And Bobby Kennedy started at 18, 20. Now he's in the low 30s also. Trump is easily on the ballot because he's the leading Republican candidate and will win or did win all of the primaries or necessary to be the Republican candidate. And therefore has automatic ballot status in sufficient states to win the election. You have seen, we all have seen, every mechanism possible to try to remove him from the ballot. Lawsuits, criminal prosecutions, you know, well, we have pictures of you having sexual relations with a goat, you know, whatever they can dig up. They're bringing it to bear, and they're contorting every single process like the one in New York to accomplish this. If that were Navalny, Okay, there would be hell to pay and lawyers to explain how and why. And, okay, so that's just that aspect of it. Bobby Kennedy's sin right now, politically, is that he's not running as a Democrat or a Republican. And therefore, institutionally, he has that much chance of winning the election and about that much chance of being on the ballot in enough states to make it theoretically possible.
Just to clarify, Don is making the signs of zero chance, pretty much.
Yes, zero, yes. The fundamental thing that we all know and never factor, and when we compare, for example, American elections to Russia, when these people are voting this weekend for Vladimir Putin or for any of the four candidates, those candidates get the vote. When you vote for president of the United States, your candidate doesn't get a vote. You're voting for an elector. In other words, a representative, you're basically appointing someone as a attorney in fact or something to go to the Electoral College and vote. Now, they're running as a candidate for your candidate. That's what that is. So I want to elect Bobby Kennedy. So I vote for Bobby Kennedy on the machine. And then Bobby Kennedy's elector gets one vote. And then as all of the votes come in, some magical thing happens backstage and the delegates get apportioned. Now, in some states, there's a legal obligation, but in most, there's the elector, as an elector, I'm running as a Kennedy elector. I have, and it's very interesting to use this terminology in the context of politics or law, I have a moral obligation to vote for the candidate that I said I'm going to vote for. But in fact, I may not. This is the unfaithful elector that they spoke about. They tried to organize around Trump in 2016. And in addition to that, the operation of the Electoral College sometimes requires several stages before someone has enough of a majority for it to be concluded. In other words, before somebody wins, they have several votes sometimes. My obligation, to the extent I have one at all, to vote for the person I said I would vote for, is limited to the first ballot. So if I go there as a Kennedy delegate with the instructions from my voters to make sure Trump doesn't get elected on the second ballot, I can vote for Trump if I want to. That's our system. Yeah. And the people who are the product of that system are the ones pointing to Russia and saying it's not democratic. And so I've had an opportunity to explain that to a lot of people here too. And to some people, it was not news. To a few people, some of the officials and whatever. Mm-hmm. To most people, it was, because the idea of America around the world has always been that it's, it's the democratic state. And we know, looking at it now, especially with an opportunity to compare it to other places, what happens is far from that. A lot of people didn't know from the beginning.
Going back to the Russian presidential election. Now, if you look at media here in the United States, one of the first things that pops up is, well, yes, Putin is popular, but people wouldn't be going out to vote unless they were being forced by their workplaces or their institution of higher learning. How do you see that?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I'm amazed at the pride people are taking. I'm seeing the people. We're sitting at the polls and talking to them. The kids come up to us and they're talking and they're happy. I've seen a couple of instances with, I'm guessing people are 12, 14 years old, go into the ballot, into the box with their mother or father, and they let them mark the ballot for them. They, touch it and help them put it on the machine. And they're very proud when it's done, like it's a rite of passage. And I'm getting a sense from the people, from talking, some deeply with people, that it's a rite of passage for the people here too, in a different way. Russia is a country that's just sort of coming into its own right now. It's kind of a nice thing to watch. The people take a pride in this election here that is difficult to explain to people where we are, where the people are very cynical about elections because of what we have witnessed and, seen, and what we're looking at now is not helping either. I don't see that here at all. I think the only way you could stop people from going to the polls would be under duress, lose your job, gun to your head, whatever. Otherwise, they seem very happy to participate.
Mm-hmm. Last time I checked the records, I think it was yesterday, after the first day of voting, about 30% of eligible voters had voted. And in the new territories, I'm talking about, the Donetsk, Lugansk, Zaporozhye, and Kherson, it was up to 70%. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes. And also, as of the close of business Saturday, it was the second day, was over, the aggregate nationally was over 53%, I think, when they were tallying it up before I fell asleep. It's probably closer to 55, 56 when we open the polls today. They're expecting today to be the big day, really. So, that's already more than we get in a presidential election in the United States. And so, it's not the way it's advertised in the West at all. It's an interesting and somewhat inspiring exercise to witness, because I can see people feel like they finally have control of their country and of their lives, and they're proud of it, and they're grabbing onto it. It's something that I would like to be able to bring back home and share.
That was Pacifica contributor Don DeBar in Krasnoyarsk, Russia, speaking to Capitalism, Race, and Democracy's Polina Vasilyev.
Собирала деньги вся деревня. Сторож утром рано проснулся, посмотрел в окно и встрепенулся. Где же ворота? Вчера были тут, ищи свищи.
That was Balakir, ishi svishi. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. A major attack on Medicare is taking place in the U.S. through Medicare Advantage. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke with New York City retiree and American Federation of Teachers Professional Staff Congress member Carol Lang. Lang also belongs to the 1.3 million member American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Workers, also known as AFSCME.
Carol, first of all, why don't you go over briefly what has been an ongoing struggle to defend healthcare in New York for city employees?
Well, over the past 3 years, it really is not all city employees. In fact, their healthcare is being degraded now again. But this is over the retirees. The retirees were promised that because our salaries were so low, that at the end of the day, when we finally retire, we would be guaranteed not only Medicare, which is federal, but we would be guaranteed senior care. Basically, that means that the city is going to pay 20% towards the 100% that we need for our health care. So the federal government pays 80, the city pays 20. And the city has been trying to renege on that over the last 3 years because it will save them $600 million.
And apparently, the city workers, including yourself, learned that union leaders in New York representing the city employees were secretly meeting with the management of the city to make this deal, this $600 million deal, where the city would not have to be responsible for that healthcare coverage.
The Municipal Labor Committee has been secretly negotiating with all the different mayors. De Blasio is the initiator of this. He was a predecessor to Mayor Adams, who he just wants to take everything away from all city workers. And the two major unions, the UFT and DC 37, which is part of AFSCME, have been the most vocal supporters of this stealing Medicare from the union, from the seniors. The other ones have not come out. My union, the PSC, the Professional Staff Congress, had been negotiating all along, with the rest of them. But now that we have a new president, he's voted against supporting the switch from Medicare to Medicare Advantage. But also we have a 30,000 member union, and the UFT and the DC 37 have the proportionate, preponderant number of people in the MLC, so that they're the ones that say, what goes. And over time, there have been retirees that have organized lawsuits against the city, and the lawsuits have, you know, supported the demands of the seniors, but, you know, the mayors are not particularly happy. So they're going after, once again, they're going after the seniors, even though they won in court. And the DC 37 is so utterly corrupt, and so is Mulgrew of the UFT, that one of the council people put in a bill in the city council saying that seniors cannot be deprived of our hard-won health care. And the head of DC 37, Henry Guarino, was heard saying, anybody who opposes him, he's going to get them. And so he got this guy, Charles Barron, essentially was not elected for the fourth or fifth time, that, you know, to the city council, and somebody else was elected. But by and large, the union leadership is behind undermining senior care because they want to make deals with the mayor and with the administration.
And this whole Medicare Advantage scheme, which has been supported by Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Party, and allowed for the privatization of Medicare. I mean, what it means is that you, if you have an injury or you have an illness, and you need work done, you have to get approval of the insurance company. You're not going to get it done unless the insurance company approves it. So this means that workers and retirees will not get their health care done because of the needs of the profit of the insurance companies. And some people can't afford to have it done because they're low income. Is that the case?
Well, you know, I learned that actually quite personally, because I didn't know what Medicare Advantage was until I switched from Medicare to Medicare Advantage, because the Medicare Advantage people, they lie and they say, yes, this is Medicare, when in fact it's not. And so a lot of seniors are sucked in without actually knowing. So when I had to go get an MRI because I hurt my elbow, I had to get pre-approval to get my MRI, and then it was going to cost me $300, when in fact Medicare, I can get the same MRI for free. So this is going to cost billions of dollars to all the seniors who are going to have to pay for things that they don't have to pay for right now, that they're going to have to get pre-approvals for.
Now, the privatization of Medicare through Medicare Advantage, have people been educated about that by the union leadership?
Well, the union leadership is trying to support Medicare Advantage. So the people who are basically educating people, there's a group called the New York City Retirees Organization that is trying very hard to educate people, but they unfortunately don't want to call for Medicare for all. And so they're only calling for Medicare for seniors. So they have these weekly discussions on videos online. And what they pretty much want to do is put a bill into the city council, which, and this is where we will get to the what happened with the retirees local, because they funded it. So they funded the lawsuit against the city. And what this retirees local does is call out people to demonstrate in front of City Hall to support the bill, not to fight for Medicare for all. And the person who's in charge of it, her name is Marianne Pizzatola, has dug her heels in and is unwilling ever to call for Medicare for all. And when I did call for that, I got the chance to speak at one of the demonstrations in front of City Hall. She was visibly upset about the fact that I was calling for Medicare for all when her program is just Medicare for, you know, to go back to the status quo ante, basically, and not fight for health care for everybody. And I object to that. So, you know, so I can't speak at any of those rallies either. Basically, the union leadership is trying to push us into and sending out letters, flyers, saying how wonderful Medicare Advantage is and how we should not object to being transferred from Medicare to Medicare Advantage.
And what happened? There was a raid of the retirees AFSCME local in New York City, which is probably has many thousands of members.
It has more than 25,000 members, and probably even more than that. And they have endorsed, because they know that the members are really going to suffer. So they have endorsed the lawsuits and have given money to this woman, Marianne, in order to continue the lawsuits. And one day, the head of AFSCME decided that he had had enough.
That's Lee Sanders, who's the international president of
AFSCME. Lee Saunders, right, exactly. And he actually took over at DC-37 in the middle of its corruption scandals. And I happened to be a delegate at the time. So, you know, I know Lee Saunders sort of up front and personal. And anyway, he's a, you know, the bureaucrat among bureaucrats. And he sent in his goon squad to the local, the retirees local, threw everybody out, changed the locks on the door. And then we got a letter saying from the woman who's taking over, saying, we know you must think that this has something to do with the Medicare Advantage, but it doesn't. This local has not paid its taxes. And therefore, we are trying to right that wrong. But it has nothing to do with the Med. And they made sure to say that. I just recently got a letter last week saying the same exact thing from them, being a retiree.
So they basically said the physical assault on this office, shutting it down and taking it over, throwing people out, was because not of of the fact that this chapter was contributing to the fight against the attack on Medicare, but simply financial irregularities.
Right. And they didn't mention that this was an assault. They just said that they had to change the leadership because the person who was in charge, you know, had some financial irregularities, but they didn't mention how they threw everybody out and changed the locks.
This whole issue of privatization of Medicare, it seems from what you're saying that the union leadership of the AFL-CIO, they may even have a Medicare Advantage program in the AFL-CIO, are participating in actually the privatization of Medicare. Is that the case?
Well, they are. And that also means that, in my opinion, the death of a lot of people, because if Medicare is privatized and we have to get prior authorization, and we can't get prior authorization, a lot of these people are 70, 80 years old. You know, they need to see the doctor. And if they can't get prior authorization, then they're going to die. And their Medicare Advantage is so bad that hospitals are refusing to take it.
So this is a life and death question. And people are very angry and fed up in New York, retirees. And now they're going after the city workers as well. Is that the case?
Yeah, you know, they're now changing. We as a city workers, I mean, we had like, you know, great health care for the most part. I had to pay a copay as a city worker, but for the most part, they covered everything. But now they're reducing the health care of the people who are actually working. And given the fact that the new contracts are now coming online, I don't think people are really aware of what this is actually going to mean in reality when they actually have to go to the doctor and, you know, see whether they have to get pre-approvals or any of those things, because it's untested.
That was Ask Me retiree Carol Lang, who is a professor at City University of New York and a member of the American Federation of Teachers Professional Staff Congress, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
And now it's a winter. Winter in America.
That was Gil Scott-Heron, Winter in America. On Saturday, March 23, there will be a community meeting in East Palestine, Ohio, to launch a national campaign, quote, Justice for East Palestine Residents and Workers, unquote. The campaign's main demand is that the federal government provide full health care to all residents of East Palestine, Ohio, and surrounding areas, and to any fire or emergency workers sickened by direct exposure to the toxic burn. Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke reports.
This past February 3rd marked the one-year anniversary of the Norfolk Southern freight train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, which led to large-scale toxic contamination of the local community and an unknown wider area. The massive 3-mile, 150-plus car train derailment that day was turned into a human and environmental disaster after Norfolk Southern officials ordered contractors to set a controlled explosion that burned and destroyed cars carrying chemicals including vinyl chloride, dioxin, and PCBs, all known carcinogens, causing their uncontrolled release into the air, soil, and nearby waterways. In a February 15th letter to President Biden and EPA Administrator Michael Reagan, just prior to President Biden's first tour and inspection of the stricken town, hundreds of individuals and representatives of local and regional groups urged them to declare it a major disaster and to work with federal officials and their senators and representatives to expedite the necessary assistance. Up to now, the administration has refused while seeking to assign liability to Norfolk Southern. In a March 6th Senate committee hearing, Biden's National Transportation Safety Board chairperson, Jennifer Homenby, admitted that the controlled explosion and burn was unnecessary and that the Ohio governor's and field commander's decision to allow it was based on incomplete information withheld to them by Norfolk Southern officials.
No justification to do a vent and burn. Rightfully, Norfolk Southern's contractors said ruled out hot tapping and transloading because it would have been a potential safety issue for their employees. But there was another option. Let it cool down. It was cooling down. We know for a fact that when that pressure relief device went off, that it had to have been above 185 degrees. Later, much later, over the course of 22 hours, that tank car was cooling. Not to mention the other four tank cars that were only between 64 and 69 degrees. So OxyVinyls was on scene providing information to Norfolk Southern's contractor who was in the room when the decision was made and when advice was given to the governor of Ohio, to the incident commander. They were not given full information because no one was told OxyVinyl was on scene. They were left out of the room. The incident commander didn't even know they existed. Neither did the governor. So they were provided incomplete information to make a decision.
The explosion severely contaminated the waterways and showered the town with toxic materials, which could lead to widespread and long-term health issues for residents. Capitalism, Race, and Democracy's Steve Zeltzer will be at this Saturday's event in East Palestine and will report further next week. One source for more information is the website eastpalestinejustice.com. For Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, this is Thomas O'Rourke.
And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Thomas O'Rourke, Steve Seltzer, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and myself, Van Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.